Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And after the news that the United States finally got Osama bin Laden almost 10 years after 9/11, there's renewed focus on memorializing the attacks. The official memorial at Ground Zero is being built. The 9/11 Museum is ramping up its programming for the 10th anniversary. President Obama is right now on his way to Ground Zero to lay a wreath and meet with first responders and 9/11 families. People talk about the importance of bearing witness, of honoring the dead, all toward the goal of collective healing and bringing closure and avoiding a repeat of the kinds of attacks in the future. But my next guests are having second thoughts about what they call the memory industry, and they're participating in a symposium on Saturday at NYU where they will gather to grapple with how memorializing is both necessary but also so often co-opted and manipulated. They are Lawrence Weschler, director of the New York Institute for the Humanities at NYU, who's organizing the conference, Ian Baruma, frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books and professor at Bard, and Kanan Makia, professor of Middle East Studies at Brandeis University. And they all have connections to this in their writing and in their lives. Welcome back to WNYC, each of you. Hello.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you for inviting us.
And Ren Weschler, the symposium was your idea. It's called Second Thoughts on the Memory Industry. First of all, what do you mean by the memory industry?
Well, first of all, I want to say second thoughts. In other words, everybody in this symposium, and there's something like 15 or 20 people, including those and Philip Gurevich and Jill Perez,
who's written about Rwanda,
and Jill Perez and Susan Mizellis, the photographers, and a whole group, Eric Boghossian, who's talking about Armenia and so forth. They have street cred as people who you could say have first thoughts. I've spent a lot of my own life. I've written about torture in Latin America, in Iraq, in South Africa. I have emphatically been somebody who believes that you do need to honor and memorialize these people and so forth. Having said that, I think there is a temper around when I was talking with many of these people over the recent periods that, you know, something's wrong. Something has happened. The whole reification of what literally is an industry. One of the things that's going to happen at the conference at 8 o'clock in the evening, Ben Catcher has done an opera called Memorial City about a town that goes crazy and starts building monuments to everything and about the architects and the experts who solace them, you know. And there is the fetishization, the ossification, the co-optation of memory is something that I think concerns a lot of us. We can talk about it in terms of the Holocaust, of Armenia, of 9/11, and so forth.
And some of the concepts that you bring in, you call them competitive victimization, Holocaust tourism, hallowed ground, ossification, even genocide Olympics. You want to take one of those?
Well, I mean, just to take any of them. I mean, this is certainly something that occurred to me when I was covering Bosnia, where you had this kind of sense that memory had so ossified, had so become so fetishized that you were in places where it wasn't like the past was haunting the present. It was more like the people who were alive were haunting the truly vital things there, which were the past. I mean, there's the great story about somebody who goes to a Serbian soldier after a massacre and says, you know, what happened here? And the answer is, well, in 1389, blah, blah, blah. And that kind of reification of getting stuck in the past, of not moving on. The issue is not that we mustn't forget, but we have to figure out a way to over-get and get over and
get
move
over.
On.
And listeners, does this sound like anything that you've grappled with from whatever nationality or ethnic group or other that has suffered some real victimization in the past? Is this something you've grappled with maybe from generation to generation in your family or whatever? If you want to join this conversation about over-memorializing or the memory industry or genocide Olympics or call it what you will, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Kanan Makia, welcome back. It's been a long time.
It has. It has. Thank you for inviting me.
You wrote a book called The Monument about this huge monument called the Victory Arch in Baghdad, the city where you were born. It's supposed to commemorate Iraq's victory over Iran in that war in the 80s, a victory that never happened. The book is about art and politics and how culture can be manipulated. Talk about where you see art as vulnerable to political manipulation or wherever else you enter this conversation.
Well, that book is a good entry point. I mean, I wrote that now 20 years ago. And when I returned to Iraq post, 2003, like so many other Iraqi expats, I had a deep commitment to building a remembrance museum in Baghdad around that very monument, and worked with the mayor of Baghdad, worked with several political authorities, got a very long lease on it, started to do designs with some Lebanese architects. I put together a whole group of people who worked really hard on memorializing that site. The site used to be called Celebration Square. Saddam used to hold his kind of Nazi-like rallies of tanks and guns going underneath those arches back in the 80s and in the late 80s and 90s. And we wanted to change the name to Remembrance Square, and the arches and the museum that would be Holocaust Museum, Holocaust Museum that would be built around there would be the point of departure, supposedly, for a renovation of whole Baghdad. But it all went terribly wrong. And one of the lessons, I learned, again, like Ren said, this is about second thoughts. I mean, I still think the basic instinct, obviously, I spent a lifetime writing about victimhood and victimization and victims, and I think the basic instinct to remember what was done is a completely sound one. But there is such a thing as remembering too much or remembering too soon. Is perhaps not always are people ready to remember. Remembering is a choice we make. It's not history. It's not the way things actually were. It's a choice I impose upon the past and say, I choose to look upon these terrible events and say they are central. And that is a political act. That's a subjective act, something I choose to do. Not everyone is ready to do that. You have to be sufficiently removed, it now seems to me, after 7 or 8 years into the overthrow of the Saddam regime. A society has to be ready. And I'll be honest with you, our project, while very valuable and perhaps, it certainly is going on, is perhaps came too soon and we had too many hopes. So I've now learned that there are certain things you do, perhaps in quiet. The country at large is not yet ready for that much remembering. And so you take distance. You do quieter things, less public things, and so on. I could tell you stories about this whole, of other things that went wrong, but there is a sense in which people coming out of 30 years of abuse, as in Iraq, are just not ready to deal with it. And a society, I'm talking societally, of course there are lots of enthusiastic young people, it's like the kind of people who joined our NGO and still work there. But
if you're not ready, then you deal with it in ways that may be counterproductive
for the
country.
Exactly. You start to politicize it. You start to use it in your sectarian wars with one another and so on.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with three participants from a conference that will take place at NYU this weekend, Second Thoughts on the Memory Industry. And let me bring the third participant in, Ian Baruma. Ian, you've lived much of your life in both Europe and Japan. You wrote a book called Wages of Guilt, Memories of War in Germany and Japan, about the different ways those countries memorialized World War II. You basically conclude that Germany is coming to grips with it while Japan tries to ignore it and move on. Is that a good shorthand for your conclusions?
Not quite. You have to qualify that. West Germany dealt with it quite well. East Germany is a different story. And the Japanese didn't exactly ignore it. The Japanese, in Japan, it was a much more politicized issue. In West Germany, or in the whole of Germany, everybody except a marginal group of nuts can agree that Nazism was bad and that Hitler was bad. In Japan, there was no Hitler. There was no Nazi period. And so the war memory is more complicated, and the way people think about the war in Japan depends very much on their politics.
There was a pretty brutal Japanese Empire.
Yes, indeed. But of course, most empires had periods of great brutality. The war was certainly brutal. The way the Japanese behaved in China and Southeast Asia was brutal. But there are many Japanese who acknowledge that. It's just that quite how you assess that history depends very much on one's political point of view.
And do you conclude that either the German approach or the Japanese approach is more functional for their societies?
Well, I mean, the thing is that we can't assume that the war as it took place, the actual history in Asia, was exactly the same as what happened in Europe and in the Soviet Union in World War II. They were different kinds of wars. And so the response to it also would have to be different. I would add one other thing, listening to make a more general point, which is I think it has a lot to do with shifting identities, this memory industry. That people used to identify with religion or their village or their tribe or their ethnic group and then their nation. This has all become much more fluid. Fewer people identify with religion. Certainly in America, the memories of the old country are fading, and then instead of that comes this rather quasi-religious identification with shared suffering, with a history of shared suffering. And I think it has a religious component, and it has it's the most emotive way to feel that you're still part of some kind of community, and it's not an entirely healthy phenomenon.
Let me bring in a caller here. Yocasta in Kew Gardens. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for calling.
Basically, I definitely see that there is a over-glorification of past events.
Do you want to talk about where you're coming from, your own past, and where it enters?
My parents are both Dominican, from the Dominican Republic, and I was born here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I remember growing up hearing many Dominicans reminiscing on their past history with Haiti and how Haiti and Dominican Republic have been at very distinct points of views many times throughout both of their histories, sharing this island. Dominicans, not all, some, have a specific view and remember the history a certain way, while Haitians remember it from their own point of view. I remember having Haitian friends that I got along great with. I loved going over their house and, you know, celebrating different holidays with them. And I also remember, you know, some Haitians not wanting to deal with me because I was Dominican.
And certainly people from different groups that have been in conflict will have different memories. So what's the lesson? What's the takeaway for Dominicans or anyone else?
I think that we have to be careful, especially when generations have passed on and these conflicts somewhat cease to exist, not to remember situations as prevalent situations that must continue. Certainly, Dominican Republic and Haiti have had their shared differences, but that doesn't have to continue with our generation. And where I think the glorification piece comes in is that, you know, governments manipulate sometimes that information that their citizens have of different cultures to their benefit. I think we have to be wary of that.
Thank you very much. Yeah. So, Rena's wonderful caller.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
She could be one of your conferees as well.
I hope she'll come on Saturday morning. She put me in mind of one of the poems that I'm going to end the conference with, which is from Szymborska, the great Polish poet, Wisław Szymborski, who in answer to all the other Polish poems that are all about the weight of history and all that kind of, you know, that you must never forget and so forth, she recently wrote a poem called Reality Demands. And she says, reality demands that we also mention this. Life goes on. It continues at Kanai and Borodino, at Kosovaya Polje and Guernica. There's a gas station on a little square in Jericho and wet paint on park benches in Bilahora. Letters fly back and forth between Pearl Harbor and Hastings, which I think is an incredible image, you know. And elsewhere in the poem, she says, every field is a battlefield, is or was a battlefield. At a certain point, you have to move on. And I think this is particularly one other thing I would add to this. If I think about the last decade, thinking about 9/11 today, 100 years from now, if there is 100 years from now, and I'm assuming that global warming is going to kick in, the years from 2000 to 2010 will be seen as the fulcrum period where things needed to be done. This was the key moment, and people will look back and what were we spending our time thinking about during this decade? And instead of facing the future in a conscious way, we have been overwhelmingly grappling with these ghosts of the past, and it's a real problem.
That's anticipated memory. If global warming is real, people may be remembering this in this way in 100 years.
And not looking at us very happily.
We're going to take a break for a minute. Then when we come back, I want to talk more directly about where 9/11 enters this conversation of second thoughts on the memory industry. And we'll touch on the Holocaust as well and take more of your calls. And boy, do people want to talk about this. Our lines filled up right away with people from all kinds of backgrounds. So Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're talking with three participants in a conference to be held at NYU this weekend called Second Thoughts on the Memory Industry, grappling with how memorializing is both necessary after violent attacks like 9/11 and so many other things around the world and through history, but also so often co-opted and manipulated through concepts like competitive victimization, Holocaust tourism, hallowed ground, ossification, and a genocide Olympics. My guests are Lawrence Weschler, director of the New York Institute for the Humanities at NYU, who's organizing the conference, Ian Baruma, frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books and a professor at Bard, and Kanan Makia, professor of Middle East Studies at Brandeis University. And we have so many callers waiting. I do want to relate this specifically to 9/11 and the phrase never forget. That phrase became inextricably linked to 9/11. Mm-hmm. It underlies the push to finish the 9/11 memorial. It's central to the mandate of the 9/11 Museum. But it's also been slapped on cheap T-shirts and on posters with superimposed images of the American flag, bald eagles, and the Twin Towers. This stuff is sold, obviously, at Ground Zero, which has become a big tourist destination. Ian Baruma, I wonder if you think of this about Ground Zero or Holocaust tourism and when that becomes problematic.
Well, it becomes problematic when the never forget gets linked to an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, when it leads to feelings of vengeance. And that, of course, is something that has troubled the history of many countries, and we have to be aware of that. I mean, the pop culture stuff of it is not in very good taste, but it doesn't bother me so much. It's more when people get involved in 9/11 in a political sense and it takes a general sort of anti-Islamic or anti-Muslim attack, and then it becomes very troubling.
And Kanan Makia, professor of Middle East Studies at Brandeis, expat from Saddam Hussein's Iraq. On our comments page, somebody writes, "Never forget is a dangerous mantra if people interpret it as also meaning never forgive."
That's right. That's absolutely right. And in fact, picking up on Ian's last point, I mean, the trick or the art of memory is to make it something that is healing, that is a common denominator rather than something that's divisive. The moment language of hate, of vindictiveness enters into it, you've lost it, and it turns into something else entirely. With that is not an easy thing to make happen, and it would not be easy with 9/11 any more than it was easy in Iraq. I mean, it's when if you can do that, it becomes a way of building identity. Exactly. I mean, when we entered Iraq, we all knew there was a really serious problem of what was it, what did it mean to become an Iraqi, to be an Iraqi post Saddam. This was a really important question, and I thought about these questions in light of the answer that perhaps the legacy of pain can be a common denominator that brings all our Iraqis together. But that takes a great art to make that happen in politics. And it didn't happen in Iraq. It failed. It signally failed to happen. And there's another side to this. we live in an age where it is impossible to forget. I mean, it's just nothing can be forgotten anymore. This is a feature of our age. Certainly wasn't true of the 19th century of other times.
But because of media technology or something else?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. All you have to do is stick 9/11 to Google and everything that ever was will be out there. So it does change the nature of the discussion over this, because there's no possibility that we will ever forget 9/11. That's no longer the question. So there were times when genocides were ignored, the Armenian one being a classic one. Nobody paid attention to them. Nobody recorded them. They were not proper. There was no means. There were no eyewitnesses. There was nothing. And so it only, you know, few individuals struggled to keep something alive.
And so it's how to memorialize constructively, how to remember constructively.
That's right.
Do you think, Anand, that it's at all inappropriate for President Obama to be going to Ground Zero at this moment, or is it a politically motivated move to capitalize on his successful elimination of bin Laden and nothing more?
I understand why he's doing it. I think it's not in the finest tradition of American policy. It's not in the sort of the greatness of the decision he made not to release the photograph. That, I thought, was a, you know, true statesmanship. So this is I think he's now genuflecting in a different direction for political reasons.
On the other hand, Ren, it's a perfectly legitimate impulse to try to close the loop by going down there. Certainly the first thing that I wanted to do Monday morning after the news was open up the phones so families of 9/11 victim members,
right,
family members of 9/11 victims could speak publicly.
Yeah. And that's fine. I mean, what bothered me, if we're talking about 9/11, and then we can talk about the Holocaust for that matter, is hallowed ground. It's cliches of commemoration. I mean, the first thing that at the time, for example, that all 3,000 victims were described as heroes. You know, often it's category confusion. Let's try to. Another way of putting this is the difference between memory and history. Timothy Snyder, the author of that great book about Europe between Hitler and Stalin, is going to be our keynote speaker. And he makes a great point about there's too much memory and too little history, trying to figure out exactly what happened, and as partly a way of inventory and then moving on. I mean, I am less concerned about the immediate things happening today than I was a few months ago about the insane hallowed ground conversation in a place that there were porn shops, there were everything else, that
right,
suddenly you couldn't have this in hallowed ground, whatever that meant.
And the Islamic Cultural Center, that debate.
Yeah.
Magda in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Magda.
Good morning. I'm just calling to say I agree completely with everything the gentlemen have said, and I appreciate the call from the lady, and the concept of how we forget and how we label. And
what's your own background or relationship to this?
My own background is I was born in Beirut in Lebanon, and I was educated there, and I came to the States for graduate school, and then I got married here and I stayed. But my link to the issue of memory and war and violence and everything you gentlemen are discussing this morning has to do with my losing my best friend, and not only losing the person, but actually seeing that person in the morgue. I and his brother were the only people who actually saw him in the morgue. And so it wasn't a person who had just passed away and I hadn't seen him again or just heard of it over the news. I had actually seen his body in the morgue by myself as a 20-year-old, and it's taking me.
And so did you have to work to get over that initial very real and, you know, an understandable impulse of never forget the wrong that was done to my friend?
I have not forgotten for a day. Not for a day have I forgotten that, but, and it's taken me years to actually pick up the phone and call you, but the way to never forget is to never allow this to happen to anybody else. Mm-hmm. Nobody else should lose a child, a friend, a brother, a lover, a sister, anybody. None of us. And I've been saying for the past 9 months, may God have mercy on all the people we lost. on the Arabs, on the Jews, on the Christians, on the Muslims, on the Pakistanis, on the Saudis, on the Iraqis, on us all. May God have mercy on all the people we loved and we lost. Every mother, every human that lost anybody. Grief.
Every mother and every son.
Every son.
Yeah. And every daughter. Marg, so beautifully
son.
Put. I'm glad you finally picked up the phone and called me.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Oh,
thank
gosh. I mean, that would be a great last thought to end on. Mm-hmm. We've got a couple of minutes. Ren, do you want to tell our listeners about the conference and who can actually come and how?
It's absolutely open to the public, and it's free, and it's all day long. It starts at 10:45 on Saturday at the Cantor Film Center at NYU, which is 36 East 8th Street. We are going to have sessions about the Holocaust. We're going to have sessions about Francine Prose and Art Spiegelman are going to be talking about the Holocaust, among others. Eric Boghossian and Nancy Agabian are going to be talking about Armenia. Nancy Agabian is an Armenian writer who has this wonderful song that she's written, I Don't Want to Be a Victim Anymore. And they'll talk about what it is to be the fifth generation after a Holocaust. And we'll also have, we're going to have this opera of Ben Catcher's. We're going to have James Young, who was on the Memorial Committee, will be there. It's just going to be all day long through 9:30 in the evening.
It sounds amazing. We'll put a link to it on our webpage. We have 30 seconds left, and we've been talking about all these excesses from all these different places and times. Ian, is there a positive example to mention just very briefly? I'm thinking maybe the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa or something like that.
Well, I think there are obviously problems with the Truth and Reconciliation Committee.
Clearly.
Don't get us started.
The positive side of it is that certain unpleasant truths are publicly acknowledged, and that can mean a great deal to victims, and I think, is one of the most important aspects
and
of remembering.
Reconciliation was part of the title and part of the job.
Yes, and you can't reconcile without the public acknowledgement of what happened.
All right. Lawrence Wechsler, Ian Baruma, Kanan Makia, an amazing discussion, and I'm sure it'll be an amazing day at the Cantor Theater.
Cantor Film Center, 36 East 8th Street.
On Saturday.
Starting at 10:45.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer at WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and Bird Week is almost over. As you've been hearing on the show, we've partnered with the New York Times to create an interactive map of bird-watching spots throughout the five boroughs. We still need your help. Text the word BIRD to 30644 and then follow the prompts. You'll be asked to submit the location where you like to look for birds and the kind of bird you last saw there. You can also record in your own voice a story about your bird watching. We will then create a map of the best bird watching spots in the city. Almost 450 people have done this already. Just text BIRD to 30644 and we'll wrap up Bird Week and present the interactive map tomorrow on the show.